I don't think anybody in the department was experienced. When we began, the person responsible for promoting women's sports couldn't type.
Oh, dear.
The department was separate from the men's department, had its own budget.
Yeah.
You might think, well, that's good, but it wasn't particularly good because we didn't have access to the same resources. But all of that pales with the opportunity for women to play. And because you were there the year before I got there, you know how excited women were to play. And I don't recall anyone ever hanging their head about what they didn't get or, you know, what type of per diem they had or the fact they had to sleep two to a bed or that we traveled in station wagons to matches. That really wasn't the point.
This is the Leave It Better podcast, powered by the Side Out Foundation. Here's your host, Hall of Fame coach, Janice Kruger.
In this episode, you're going to hear from my dear friend, Terry Pettit. The first time I met Terry Pettit, I was a 22-year-old second semester senior on the Nebraska volleyball team, whose job was to follow Terry's practice plan, which was a part of the criteria for his job interview to be the next head coach at the University of Nebraska. I don't remember many things about that practice, but I remember being there and thinking, wow, this is pretty cool that I'm part of something that's, who knows where this is going to go with this new coach that's coming into the program. Things about Terry, such a renowned head coach and someone who's built this incredible program, I find it interesting to sort of look behind the scenes of his journey and just the paths and the experiences that he had to become the legendary coach that he is and to have built a program to the extent of, at this point in time, drawing 92,000 people to a football stadium to watch Nebraska volleyball play in the month of August before preseason is truly incredible at how he has built the state into a volleyball powerhouse with so many fans, right? 92,000. He wouldn't necessarily have thought this of his younger self, that he was actually an advocate for all things. And if you've had the opportunity to hear Terry speak, you are well aware of his abilities to tell a story that connects you to the human condition, that brings a thought and provoking and entertaining storytelling to light that will bring you to tears and make you laugh till you just your stomach hurts. In my research with him, I discovered that he has this love of being in timeouts. And I believe there was something like 3,000 timeouts in his coaching career that he was a part of. And he goes through the structure of it and sort of the, you know, the ins and outs of having a good timeout and the all the parameters involved there. But he talks about one particular moment in time. And I remember being in the crowd watching Nebraska play. And he took a timeout and things were not looking so good for Nebraska at that time. And he said some things to his team and he talks about that here. And it may only be a coach's curiosity to hear what's said during that timeout, but I'm kind of thinking that most people in the gym or in the stadium are curious about what kind of things are being shared and then watching what happens once that timeout is over. And I think he really describes that. In fact, right now I'm getting goosebumps thinking about that particular moment in time that he talks about here and shares with us. It's truly fun. It's the part of coaching and being involved in women's athletics that has been such a cool journey and one that I love that he shared with us. Terry, thank you so much for joining me today. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Janice. I hope that's a big red cap behind you on that bookcase.
It is. It is. I put that there especially for you.
it could be a Maryland cap.
Maryland. Yeah. No, it's an N. It's an N. I put that one behind it for now. Thanks for asking. So, Terry, what I'd like to do today is we'll kind of touch on some of these subjects. And one of them is I'd like you to just give me a little history of your journey of coaching. Not so much that I'm just looking for all these pieces, but people sometimes like to know the beginnings of such a guy that was able to create a program like Nebraska's and just kind of where you came from and how you got there.
Well, like almost everybody, including Janice Kruger, things come about by accident. I think in your case, you heard volleyballs in a gym and went upstairs to investigate it. In my case, I was at a junior college peppering with somebody, and this guy comes up and asks if I'd played on it, would play on his team, and went to the practice in downtown Chicago. And it happens that the coach was the 68 Olympic coach, Jim Coleman. And so I played with Kenneth Allen for 2 years, and yes, I was a Scribini, probably the worst player on the team. But it gave me an advantage, and at least that I was familiar with the game. Other people that were there at the time, McHaley was a setter on the team who later coached at Texas and USC. Jerry Angle was the coach at Northwestern. So when I got my graduate degree from the University of Arkansas in creative writing and started looking for jobs, I just got in a car and drove across the country and walked into places and found, had three job offers. And one of them was at this junior college in North Carolina. And I liked it because it reminded me of my undergraduate college. And the president saw on my resume that I had played volleyball. Title IX had just come in, and he asked me if I would coach the team. He didn't tell me it was a women's team because there wasn't women's sports, so I didn't know what to think. None of the 30 women or so that showed up had ever played before at any level. And so we didn't cut because, we felt it was important that everybody have the opportunity. The first match we played, I think we lost the first set. I know we lost the first set 15-0. We didn't rotate, but we got better. And 2 weeks later, we beat that team on their home court. We had one volleyball.
Oh, no.
But I met some interesting people. Beth Miller.
Oh, yeah.
Beth Miller was the head coach at North Carolina. And our third year, we were competing with those teams and having success against North Carolina and KU at North Carolina State. And I really thought that I would, if I moved on, it would be as an English teacher to Guilford or High Point or a liberal arts college in North Carolina. But Paul Sandiford, who was the women's volleyball coach, pulled a flyer out of a wastebasket, handed it to me. One was, or actually two flyers. One was to Minnesota and one was to Nebraska. Minnesota, when I called, said they would definitely hire a female coach. Nebraska said I could interview, but I would have to drive myself. They weren't going to pay for an interview. And I really didn't know what the procedure was at that point. If I'd known, I probably wouldn't have done it. So it took me 3 days to drive across the country and interview, and the interview was actually running a practice for four or five players who were there during the summer. I think they offered the job to a young graduate from UCLA who had played at UCLA, and she turned him down. In the meantime, I'd retreated to my home in Crown Point, Indiana. They called me, and I thought about it for a couple days, thought it would be okay if I did this for maybe 3 or 4 years, and then I would return to being a creative writing teacher. But that never happened. So accepted the job. I don't think anybody in the department was experienced. When we began, the person responsible for promoting women's sports couldn't type.
Oh, dear.
The department was separate from the men's department, had its own budget. And you might think, well, that's good, but it wasn't particularly good because we didn't have access to the same resources. But all of that pales with the opportunity for women to play. And because you were there the year before I got there, you know how excited women were to play. And I don't recall anyone ever hanging their head about what they didn't get or, you know, what type of per diem they had or the fact they had to sleep two to a bed or that we traveled in station wagons to matches. That really wasn't the point. It was slow going. While I'd coached 3 years at Lewisburg, it's different relating to a large institution. And it took me a while to figure that out. It took me a while to travel the state and understand who the people were, what the culture was. It was a culture that really fit me. Much of Nebraska and Minnesota and Western Iowa, they're basically people that are not really concerned with self-promotion. It's more of a humble culture. Show me what you can do. And I like that aspect to it. I like the people. That's certainly, I wouldn't have stayed there had I not. So I ended up coaching there a lot longer than I thought I would and left probably at the peak of my career when I was 53 and we just, our freshman class, that my last year of coaching was the number one class in the country with tremendous talent. And then recruited John Cook to jump on the horse.
Yeah. Yeah. Literally, he does do that.
Well,
with his cowboy hat.
John understands how demanding coaching is and that you have to have something that you can do where you won't think about it. And for me, that was golf. John went through golf and then he went through flying a single engine airplanes. And I suppose compared to that, riding a horse is safer, but not much. I admire what he's done. I respect how hard he's worked.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, those five people that were in that practice when you were there interviewing? Do you remember me? I was out there.
Yeah, yes.
I was a part of you, Terry. I was a part of that.
Yeah.
It's just fun to hear the journey of young coaches that have gone through and built programs like you have. The next one I'd like to ask you, Terry, and this is really for people that are now coaching or maybe thinking about getting into coaching. And I believe it's a necessary component of someone that's in the field working with athletes and in athletic departments is to have a very sound coaching philosophy. Can you tell us just a little bit of that, how that was for you when you started coaching so many years ago, and then how did it change along the way? Would it be different today? I know I read your resume that you created after retirement. I got a big, big kick out of that.
Well, I was fortunate in having a father who was my coach, and I understood behaviors before I understood a philosophy. You know, he was curious. He had great attention to detail. He had different ways of teaching us. He was patient. So I understood those things without understanding maybe the broader vision. I think of Steve Martin's book, Born Standing Up, where he breaks his career into three different levels. And I would do the same thing. You know, my first 3 or 4 years at Nebraska, it was about survival. I was so overwhelmed with all the adjusting to things that I just hoped that the team would be successful enough that I could be asked to come back. We were on a monthly contract for most of my coaching career. Oh. And I wasn't particularly good at some things. I got lucky in my first recruiting class. I recruited two kids, Shandy Patine from Colorado, who later became a left-handed middle blocker and a player. And Terry Knaus, who was our first All-American. But if you look at the next couple of classes, I was doing what, trying to do what everybody else did, which was recruit skill. And by, so I would go recruit maybe the best skilled player in Nebraska, but that player might not have the size, the arm speed, the vision to be an extraordinary college player, or maybe more specifically, a player who could beat Southwest Missouri, or a player who could beat UCLA, or a player that could beat USC. And then, you know, I stumbled on something, a belief, a core belief that changed everything. And that was, I recruited talent with the belief that we could teach them skill. And obviously, if you can recruit somebody who's talented and already has the skill, that's ideal. That's who was UCLA and San Diego State was were recruiting at the time. But if you want to beat those teams, you can't go recruit the third best, third level of skilled players and ever hope to beat them. And I think working with Knaus probably taught me that, that this person who had a, you know, a close to a 30-inch jump could do things that I couldn't teach other people to do. And Kathy Noth taught that, you know, made me realize that even better. This lady who'd never played club volleyball comes in and can grab the rim. She was equally good in softball or basketball. But within a month, she's dominating matches. And not only that, she's an eager learner. She's coachable. So, you know, in the classes following that, where Annie Adamczak and Sharon Kramer and Karen Dahlgren, you know, the whole recruiting philosophy changed. And we were ahead of the curve. So from that point on, we never went out on the court. And I looked across the net and said, wow, they're better athletes than we are. I never felt that. And in particular, I never felt the opponent had a better setter. And so that, you know, I stepped back from the game and said, you know, what can we do to always have a setter that is puts us in position to compete? And that really came about from training Tisha Delaney, because all of a sudden we had somebody who hadn't had any training. And so I contacted all the people around the country that I thought did a good job of that and listened to them, and then trained Tisha and Nikki Stricker and Catherine, my own daughter, and let them train me. So it was a laboratory. Yes. I tried to figure out, how does this kid move better than another kid? And so they all might have slightly different posture. They might use slightly different levers. But if we could get them to be consistent, that didn't make a difference. You know, that didn't make any difference. And then we started to get a brand for playing fast and having great setters. And if you have great setters, you can attract great middles. And it was more of a middle and right side dominant game at that point. But you know, there's a lot of luck and a lot of curiosity that leads to that, that, you know, being open to anything impacting your career.
I remember you having the great athletes, and we had time to train skill. And we had, you know, enough matches in a year to, you know, be able to give them the experience that they needed. And that it was definitely something that was a recognizable piece of your program once you got started, is that athlete that you were bringing in. They were just phenomenal. I did not realize that Kathy Noth hadn't played club volleyball till just now.
You only get lucky if you keep turning over the leaves. You know, have you ever looked for mushrooms, Janice?
No, I have not.
I used to look for mushrooms along the Platte River. And at first you don't see them. They're hard to see. And there's all these leaves on the ground, but you got to keep brushing away the leaves. And then maybe you get lucky. Some days you don't.
Hi there, Janice here. I want to take a minute to tell you about something very personal and important to me, my job. I'm the brand ambassador to the Sight Out Foundation, and I've been a part of it since it began about 20 years ago. Believe it or not, I was recruited to join the Sight Out team by the founder's father. He looked me up online and asked me out to lunch. That's when I got to learn more about his wife, Gloria. Gloria is the reason this Sight Out Foundation exists. Her son and husband wanted to give her more time, and it worked. Gloria was this fiery redhead that was so full of energy and joy and happiness. They'd invite me and my partner over to Thanksgiving, and Gloria would dance around the house. She always made me feel so welcome. I joined the team at Sight Out for the very same reason we get athletes involved with our Dig Pink program, because I wanted to be a part of something bigger than myself. I wanted to see Gloria have more time, and I was thinking about all my female friends I could potentially be helping. One of the goals of this podcast is to let people know that they can help us help people living with metastatic breast cancer see more tomorrows. How? By harnessing the passion and power of youth volleyball to raise money that will go toward real research and clinical trials that really do give families more time with their loved ones. That's one of my favorite things about this job, is that you can actually see the results of our research and how it helps give people more time. For more information, head to our website, side-out.org. Now back to the show.
But you have to be willing to do it. I see a lot of young coaches that get the job and the first thing they want to do is change the furniture or worry about the car they're getting, you know, but it's all about talent. Right. It's all about clay to a potter. You want the best clay you can possibly have.
So you're giving me some examples here of how you see the world and rolling over those leaves to find the mushrooms and the clay to make that great pot. And I have always thought that you are such an amazing storyteller, Pettit. You've had me laughing so hard. You've had me crying. And so this ability, I'd like to see how this connected for you in your development of different aspects of your program. Like how were you able to use that, or did you use that in areas of like motivation for your team or development of leadership, and maybe even in recruiting, as you tell the story and paint the picture of Nebraska?
Possibly in recruiting some, probably more in generating interest with fans or supporters. I'll give you one example. In our last match to determine the Big 8 champion, before we moved to the Big 12, we were playing Texas. And every November, we would play Texas at least once and sometimes twice. And Mick Haley and I, the coach, scheduled that so that we would be prepared to play nationally competitive teams when we went in the tournament. And I walked into the locker room, and we'd had good success with Texas, but we're in Austin, and Lisa Reitzma was very pensive, seated on the bench. I said, "Lisa, what are you anxious about?" And she said, "Coach, I want to know that we win the match and that I play well." And I said to her, "Lisa, what if I tell you that I know that?" And the point was not that I was some Houdini. The point was that if you can set that aside and assume you're going to play as well as you possibly can, then you're going to play better. I mean, we were the better team, and we went out and we won the last Big 8 championship, then played Texas in the Big 12 the following year. But there were times where players might be annoyed with my storytelling, particularly if they'd heard it 8 or 9 times. And, you know, but I'll take this in another direction. We all create our own story.
Okay.
It's in our mind. You know, Janice Kruger is the main character in her story. And sometimes we even will fudge on facts or history or something to make that story align, to make it better. And I don't know that there's anything wrong with that. But we create a story in the sense of, am I the person who things don't go really well in the beginning, but I stay with it and stay with it and stay with it, and eventually it works out? Or am I the person who, man, something really special happens in the beginning and somehow it gets away? And I think it's how you see yourself, how you see the journey that you're on. I don't know that if I could have left Nebraska volleyball if I hadn't seen the former. And by that, I mean, if I hadn't thought that there were good things beyond wins and losses, because it was, it had become in some ways routine. I didn't have the motivation to be dominant. In other words, to go out and say, walk into a room and know that you're just going to beat everybody all the time. It didn't really interest me. Team building interested me, and I love the players that and the coaching staff and all that. But I also loved other things that were in books or in writing or reading. But I do think that we're consciously thinking about what our story is, where we're going with it. Every day there's new obstacles. I got a new iPhone, and all of a sudden I had 173,000 emails. I mean, that's a literal number. 173,000 unopened emails. Every email I'd ever gotten was there, unopened. And then I went I went back to T-Mobile and said, help me with this. They said, we can't help you with that. And then I went to Apple and they said, we can't help you with that. And they said, you got to get with Gmail. Gmail doesn't even have a phone you can call, you know. So I suppose I'm stuck with spending 15 minutes a day canceling these emails. This has never happened before on a phone. And I think if I'd known this, I wouldn't have traded phones, even though the phone was free.
God, I love these stories. You know, to go back just real quick on one of the things you said about your perception or how you see yourself. And this is a little bit off of where you were, but I always liked the saying that the older I get, the better I was. And I think that has shown up a few times in my recollection of things. And I think now I'm to the point where it's like, I understand that can happen. So I'm not doing it as much as I had been. But anyhow.
Janice, I ran into somebody when I was in North Carolina. And he was a coach, basketball and volleyball coach in North Carolina. And we have gone fishing and stood on rivers where you don't talk to each other all day and still felt very close. And he said something to me. I commented on how he handled a situation that I thought he handled it really well. And he said, Terry, that's easier to do when you don't care what other people think. And I thought it was a very wise remark. And that doesn't mean that you don't care what your spouse thinks or your family thinks or whatever. You always have to consider being courteous and kind. But what he meant was caring what the public thinks about you, you know, that you're working towards some image. Mm-hmm. And I took the, what is that test, personality test the other day? I just wanted to see what, where there's 12 personality types or 24. Myers-Briggs.
Right.
Yeah. Well, 16, it was either that or, yeah, one yeah, like it.
Okay.
And mine came out, and I didn't realize this, mine came out the advocate. I don't know that I would have believed that when I was 23, but as I look at myself at 77 and I look back, I have been, I'm an advocate for things. I never spoke to a group.
You are.
About Nebraska volleyball, where I didn't talk about opportunity for women, where I didn't talk about Title IX, where I didn't talk about things that hadn't happened yet. And that's very natural for me to do. And it irritates people sometimes. You know, if I want to get a happy response on Twitter, I just post "Go Big Red." If I want, the other day I posted that I didn't, just the observation that if Jim Jordan became Speaker of the House, he would be somebody who encouraged the insurrection at the nation's capital, that he would be third in line for the presidency. And somebody said, you know, God, I thought you were a great coach. You're a communist. And my response was,
yikes.
You know, if you disagree with me, I wouldn't say you're a communist or a fascist or that you like chocolate or golden doodles, because probably none of it's true. You know, you just happen to have a different point of view. But that's impossible today. I mean, we're the last
it is
7 or 8 years, people have created an environment where you have to bash everybody that disagrees with you. That's what's wonderful about sport. You agree, we're going to play by these rules. We even have a net that separates us. And in our particular sport, you don't even talk across net. And we shake hands afterwards. It's the heaven of interactions. Win or lose, you get up to go do it again.
Mm-hmm. So true. So true. In your resume, and this was, if I were to come out of retirement, this would be my resume. And I ran across this, and maybe we'll share it here when we go to send this out so people can see it. One of the things you say in there, Terry, I thought, I got to ask him a little bit about what he's talking about here, is I am better at requiring than relating, but I'll make the effort. Can you explain that for our viewers?
When I present on this to corporations and teams and everything, there are three things you have to do. You have to recruit, require, and relate. And whether it's your talent or not, you better recruit, you know. That's not a choice. But most of those three things, recruiting, requiring, and relating, most people are innately good at one of them. And you can identify with coaches. That coach is a great requirer. Okay, so Coach Bob Knight died recently. And you wouldn't have to know much about him to know he's a requirer. I think at one point in his career, he was a pretty good recruiter. I think the last probably 15 years, I don't know that he was, that he put a whole lot of energy in it. And he may have spent energy relating to certain people, but it didn't come naturally to him. You know, he had to work at it. Kathy Noth was a great relator. So in looking for my associate head coach, I want somebody with a complementary talent. So I might not be as inclusive as Kathy, but she can come up to me after practice and say, hey, this player, Kim Crandall, had a great practice on the B side of the net, and you were focused on those nine people over there on the starting unit, but she had a great practice. So then I go over and I can tell Kim that, how valuable she was. She needs to hear it from me. Mm-hmm. But it takes somebody on the staff who recognizes that, who's alert to that. The other thing that Kathy provided, if I was about to head off in a certain direction with a player or a team, I would check with her and say, am I right about this? Or do you see it the same way? Because I know her glasses are different. She sees things differently. She'll notice things. So if she says, no, Terry, that kid was tired for other reasons today, or, you know, I think we just give her more space, then I head in that direction. But if she says, no, they didn't work hard today, and they need to hear that. You don't want to see a bunch of mini-me's on your coaching staff. The three people I mentioned, Nikki Stricker-Best, and Val Novak and Kathy Noth, are independent, strong, independent people. And they would have no problem sharing with me what their opinion is. I saw the other day that Coach Cook made the statement that after every practice, the staff gets together and everybody has an equal voice. And when I was mentoring coaches at Nebraska, and Diane Mendenhall, she's now the president of the Omaha Supernovas, was the director of ops. You know, John said, how do you think we should meet? I suggested that, you know, I think Diane needs to be involved. She understands volleyball. She has a different point of view. And, you know, I think if you guys met outside your office, that she could provide valuable input. And some people might say, well, what does the director of ops have to do with the team? Well, she has everything. She interacts with those players in different ways. And that might not work for every coach, but there's too much to do to not work toward collaborative leadership. You know, a head coach has to make certain decisions. You know, I think if you watch Nebraska volleyball or Wisconsin volleyball, you may see other people step in first and say what they think to a team. And the coach, it's all built around trust. The assistant coaches and the head coach are modeling that trust every day. It takes so many things to build trust, but it takes, more than anything else, it takes time and effort. And you can't just assume that this engine is because we're winning matches, that we don't have to work at it every day. Because in the players' lives, they have a crisis every couple of days. And they don't have the field of vision to know that this will pass. That because you got a C in a chemistry test, your life isn't going to end. But for them, it feels like it is if they're trying to get in med school. So we provide that perspective from them. But I also know that my job is not to be best friends with the player, because my job is to keep providing an environment that challenges them to be better than they think they can be. And if you do that, you know, they're not going to go home and send you a Valentine. They're going to be uncomfortable.
Yeah, no.
And that's mm-hmm. the art of coaching. How can we create an environment where they trust the coaching staff, even when the coaching staff asks them to do things that they're uncomfortable with?
Getting comfortable with the uncomfortable.
Well, that's why in the recruiting process, you let them know who you are. You know, you don't tell them. Janice, I used to finish every conversation with a recruiter parents, and I would say this: look, I will never stop trying to provide the opportunity for you to be better. And so if you don't want that, every time you see me, you're going to say, get me out of here. This guy just, you know. So what I had to learn and probably didn't learn in time for some of the people I coached, John Dunning told me once that he was meeting with his, he'd meet with his setter each week and there was no agenda. No agenda at all. He'd just sit there and listen. Well, I think most of the time, I had an agenda. I wanted her to get off the net and square up to the left side.
Okay.
But I think if you're going to develop trust, you have to have time when you meet with people where you don't have an agenda.
Sure.
You know, where you're just checking in. Are you healthy? How are your friends doing? How's your mom doing? How's your, you know?
Get to know them. Yep. Checking in, getting to know them. They're important to you, right? That's what they have to feel. So, Terry, if you were to give some advice right now to coaches who have dreams of trying to take their program or build a program in this day and age, what are a couple things that you would tell them to start with or to think about?
You know, Janice, the advice I would offer first would be to athletic administrators. Mm. So let's say that you are a major university and you hire a young woman to be a head coach who's been an assistant coach for 2 years. And you're putting her in a position to fail unless you provide the support and mentorship so she can develop. Next to scholarships, universities spend more money on coaching salaries than anything else, but they don't spend any money or rarely spend any money in developing those coaches. And every coach out there could use a mentor, but particularly the coaches that could use them are their coaches who are beginning their head coaching career or even beginning a head coaching career at a different level. So when you went from Nebraska, Omaha to Maryland, you had the advantage of being a head coach, but there were challenges in the ACC that you didn't have at Nebraska, Omaha. There were also benefits, there were resources. And so you probably had to search out the women's basketball coach, or the women's soccer coach, or somebody that could help you navigate through that. Athletic departments should be providing that mentorship. That would be the first thing. The second thing is universities like Nebraska should offer a coaching curriculum where young people can intern because they think when they get into this business that coaching is about teaching someone a drop step. No, that's the fun part of it. Right. I got an email, a gentleman who's been coaching for 30 years. I got a very, very brief. I hate her. I don't want her on the team. She's uncoachable, everything. Well, that we don't, you know, we don't see those things. We don't see when one of your players is in an unhealthy relationship and is not going to listen to anyone or whose parents have been abusive or... that all enters into it. I don't know that it's any more difficult than being a school teacher today with parents that are intervening and the threat that somebody's going to walk into your school with a semi-automatic weapon. You know, I mean, everything's hard. But to think that coaching, just because you played it, is going to be easy is crazy. Because even if you're on a team today, you don't see what the coaches are doing when you're not there. You know, the challenges they have in recruiting an administrator to become emotionally involved with your program is critical. And that's a different skill than teaching someone to set a volleyball. This is why I'm such a fan of the a liberal arts education. You know, we're moving now where universities say, well, we should only be teaching courses that lead directly to being a pipe fitter or a computer, whatever. I taught William Faulkner's short story, The Bear, in freshman composition. And it's a tremendous short story about a boy that goes out and it teaches you the history of the 1920s about how a young person moved to adulthood. But at a critical point in the short story, the boy doesn't shoot the bear. And and why doesn't he? It's based on honor. It's based on respect. It's based on justice. It's based on all these values that we will carry into our lives. And so just teaching somebody the skill to go do something and earn a living is not enough. We have to, I hope there are institutions out there that continue to value music and art and literature and history. If you look at the best coaches, or many of the best coaches, they didn't study how to be a volleyball coach their whole life, or a football coach, or a basketball coach. They're wider read than that. There I am being the advocate again.
Okay. I have to ask this question. I read somewhere, you love timeouts, and you were in like 3,000 plus timeouts in your 23-year career. And so with that, is there a particular timeout that you go, yeah, that's a timeout I will never forget?
Well, I think timeouts are great. When I called a timeout, there was a time, Janice, when the team that called the timeout returned to the court, the other team had to return right away. They didn't last a specific time. So let's say your team is having a run against us, you're in a rhythm. I'd call a timeout and I would make one point, last about 8 seconds, and I'd say, okay, giddy up. And then the other team all of a sudden is very uncomfortable because they're having to come back to the court after they just started to get organized and the coach just started speaking. So that was one of the reasons I enjoyed timeouts. Another timeout that I've never told this story, but I might have one beer a month. When I was younger, I might go down to bed. Valentino's used to have what were called globes, and they were large mugs. Oh. And probably my first couple of years of coaching, I might have had one of those. But I'm not a heavy drinker. So one night I went out before we played and with friends and probably went to Valentino's and had a globe. And we had a 9 o'clock match in the morning. And I called a timeout. And all of a sudden I realized I had a buzz and I wasn't thinking. And I think I just turned to the team and said, never mind. As you were.
But oh, I'd love to hear their side of that story.
Well, they always have the other side, but for the most part, I think it's a mistake to share anything technical in a timeout. You don't want your players on the left side of their brain. Mm. You want to move them back to reacting to their training. When a player starts to think about their lift or think about their approach, you're moving in the wrong direction. So timeouts were are a way to get organized. And I think I wrote a poem about it. You're either saying giddy up or whoa.
Giddy up or whoa. Hi there. I want to take a minute to tell you about the Dig Pink program. You most likely know I've got some history as a head volleyball coach. Coaching for me was about providing opportunities for my players to grow and learn life lessons and to become the best volleyball players they could be. At the Side Out Foundation, we believe in using the power and influence of sport to build student athletes as people on and off the court. Players learn the value and importance of giving back to their community, working as a team, and taking initiative to get involved, all while directly helping people living with metastatic breast cancer and funding game-changing research. That is the Dig Pink journey. Dig Pink gives those wanting to do good a chance to be a part of something bigger than just volleyball. For more information, head to our website, side-out.org. All right, back to the show. All right, I have one. I'm going to ask you to try to remember one that I heard about. I don't know if it was true or not.
Yeah, you're probably talking about the national championship.
Yes, I am. Yeah.
That was a special team and a special year. And when you're playing a great opponent, somebody who's as talented as you and as well coached as you, you're probably going to win a set on preparation. They're going to win a set on preparation. They're going to win a set when they're on rhythm. And you're going to win a set when you're in a rhythm. But when you get to the fifth set, you've done all the coaching you can do. You know, it's at this point, it's the player's set. And so I entered that huddle knowing that the thing that I can do the most here is telling what I'm feeling and also giving them freedom to know that if they don't win this match, if they don't win this set, I still love them. It doesn't make any difference. And so Christy starts crying. She's the setter. And Allison Weston, we go out. This is against Michigan State in the semifinals. And on the very next play, I believe, Lisa Reitzma hits the ball on the block. And Jen McFadden turns and dives for the ball. Jen McFadden, 6'3 or 6'4, dives to the floor and wrists it. And the ball sails over the net, over Michigan State, and falls in the corner. And it's not a play you could make if you were in the left side of your brain. It's just a reaction. So you need grace in those situations. And all you can do as a coach is work hard to put yourself or give your team the chance to put themselves there. But what happens once you're there, that's the team's doing.
That's the team's doing. That's right. So today in your life, there is no place like Nebraska. What's that mean to you when you hear that? Well, you've got all these Nebraska players. You had all those fans. The whole state is crazy. The world right now is crazy about Nebraska volleyball. And this was something that you put your little shine on that stuff, okay? And so when you hear that, there is no place like Nebraska.
Well, I think the volleyball community's caught up in the wake that Nebraska created with that 92,000 match. That 92,000 match doesn't happen, though, if there haven't been hundreds of matches that those people were invested in prior to that. That wasn't, those weren't people that just were coming to Lincoln to do something they hadn't done. They were in it. I think Nebraskans, we were fortunate in that Nebraskans, particularly the young women that I had the chance to coach, and this would be true of the women that came from Minnesota and Iowa, and even someone like Gracia Lee from Puerto Rico. They worked when they were teenagers. Yeah. They didn't come from elite homes. They came from farms where the crop came in every other year. They had to feed the horses, or they had to sit on the tractor, or they had to sell, deliver newspapers. There's a tremendous advantage in having people on a team that have done that. because they understand what being uncomfortable is. They're more likely to be coachable. It was a tremendous advantage as a young coach at Nebraska having that culture, because I knew what, you know, I was born in Southern California, about, 10 miles from UCLA. We all knew what that culture was, but they didn't know what we were. And they weren't necessarily prepared for the type of individual that we had. And I think John has embraced that. I think Nebraskans appreciate it when you work hard. They appreciate it when you're consistent. It's good stuff.
Before this interview today, I watched a clip of the Nebraska-Wisconsin match in 2021. I think it was 2021. We lost that to them. That was their first championship for Wisconsin. What amazing volleyball and rallies and skill, execution, and strategies. I was just going, wow. It was beautiful.
Yeah. Kelly Sheffield gets it. This is a guy who never played volleyball. He was the manager of the men's volleyball team at Ball State, but he gets it, and he's very good tactically. I'm going to make a prediction. The match at Wisconsin will double any television audience that's taken place to this point.
Yeah.
I mean, there will be watch part.
1.6 something right now. What? 1.
Yeah, but they'll double that television audience.
Hallelujah, right?
There will be watch parties. People will name their kids after women that play in the match.
God, I think you're so fun.
They won't be conceived during that match because nobody's leaving the TV set.
Well, listen, Terry, thank you for working so hard to find that plug-in and for the mic and for us to have this conversation today. I'm hoping I can get you back on a number of times. You got a lot to share, and I'll probably send you some gifts or something to maybe try to convince you to be on again. But I do appreciate you taking the time.
Well, Janice, I appreciate that, but you also know that none of this happens without you. If that team doesn't have success, you know, when you're there, I probably don't take that job. You could almost point at 100 women in that program. You could say the same thing about. It just does not happen if they don't happen to be a part of that.
Good stuff, Terry. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Leave It Better podcast, powered by the Side Out Foundation. We appreciate your feedback, so be sure to check out our website, www.side-out.org.